Money FM 89.3, best of the breakfast huddle. Regional Roundup with Leslie Lopez, regional correspondent with the Straits Times on Money FM 89.3.
Money FM 89.3. Good morning. It's the Breakfast Huddle. Elliot Danka, Timothy Goh, and Ryan Huang with you. Let's pick up where it's been almost 3 months on from the military coup in Myanmar. Small progress has been made on ending the violence sparked by the February 1st takeover. That, of course, has seen over 700 people killed.
Well, the junta leader Min Aung Hlaing attended an ASEAN meeting in Indonesia over the weekend and has said that he will give careful consideration to constructive suggestions from the ASEAN bloc on ending brutality in Myanmar.
Yeah, but people in Myanmar are quite critical of the agreement with the military and ASEAN. They've said it falls short of restoring democracy.
Meanwhile, fresh fighting broke out yesterday along Myanmar's eastern border as the ethnic minority Karen insurgents attacked an army outpost there. So could this be a setback, then, to the military-ASEAN agreement?
And an interesting one, Malaysia is seeking to rescue its ailing oil and gas ecosystem with an ambitious 10-year plan after fuel prices were battered last year by the COVID-19 pandemic. Let's find out about all this and more from Straits Times regional correspondent Leslie Lopez. Leslie, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing good.
All right, let's get into it. First one being the junta from Myanmar saying that it's come to an agreement with ASEAN members to stop violence if it serves the interests of the country and when the country returns to stability. There's been a lot of back and forth, especially over the weekend, right? Tell us a little bit more about this and whether or not this is a step in the right direction.
Well, you know, commentary on this outcome of the ASEAN intervention has been mixed. Some see it as a positive move. The move the group reached some consensus on key points such as, you know, ending violence, pushing for a constructive dialogue, and also the appointment of a special envoy, perhaps, to facilitate on this dialogue. And I think clearly this is seen as positive, and, you know, getting to the group engaging with the junta. But there is also commentary on the flip side that, you know, all the meeting did was to legitimize the coup leader. And the meeting also failed to solve real issues such as, you know, pushing for the release of the political prisoners, particularly Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi. And I think, you know, the other thing that's a reality check too, it's clear that the military made it very, very clear that, you know, they would only accept ASEAN's suggestions if it served the interests of the country. So clearly suggesting that, you know, everything will be on their terms. So how this move forward, you know, we're still not in anywhere clear positive territory at this point. A lot of work needs to be done before we can get anywhere.
Leslie, fighting broke out at a military outpost in Myanmar in the eastern border with Karen ethnic army capturing an army position there. So what do you think the implications of this would be? Could it start, or rather stall, any agreement between the military and ASEAN to end violence?
Well, you know, the thing is that it shows how complex the situation is. It is just not engaging with the co-leaders. There's so many groups, not just the government leaders who are deposed, but there's so many ethnic groups all over Myanmar, such as like the Karen group is probably the oldest and most effective group, which is along the border of southern Thailand. So, you know, all of this highlights the complex situation that we are dealing with. And, you know, it will need a lot more engaging of not just the coup leaders, but also other parties involved in Myanmar politics.
Leslie, I guess we're at that juncture where we keep talking about how various economies that have been affected by COVID-19, their plans to restart if they can't be digitalized or transformed. One of it is the oil and gas sector in Malaysia. The government there announcing a 10-year plan to revive that sector. So I know we don't pay a lot of attention to it, especially out of Malaysia, but how badly did the pandemic affect the oil and gas sector? And and what's in the blueprint to revive it?
You know, the oil and gas sector, you know, which largely relies on national oil company Petronas, was really devastated. You know, really, there were, you know, a number of jobs. I think the sector contributed $50 billion to Malaysia's GDP at the end of the decade. I provided something like 60,000 highly skilled jobs. And, you know, it was a huge form of tax revenue for the government. But when oil prices fell and, you know, and industry had to close out, I mean, this was this devastated a whole lot of people. There were a lot of foreigners who had to leave the country because there were no jobs anymore. And so here is the government trying to revive the sector, clearly because the pandemic has laid bare the number of multipliers to the economy that have actually been ravaged by this, by the health crisis. So here is Malaysia trying to look at one sector that it still believes can actually contribute and help revive the domestic economy. A lot, I think a lot is going to be pinned on this 10-year plan and how I think everything is going to be in the implementation now, you know, getting Petronas to start spending again. And that in turn is a problem by itself because the Malaysian oil and gas sector completely relies on Petronas. These are not companies that have been able to, you know, to diversify their work portfolio and try and snare projects outside of Malaysia. So I think this is something that will have to be looked at.
Leslie, let's turn to another development there in Malaysia with the finance minister now saying the government will take 5 billion ringgit from the National Trust Fund for COVID-19 for vaccine procurement. Previously, this was priced at 3 billion ringgit. Now he says the cost has increased as the government is trying to vaccinate everyone by the end of this year instead of early next year. So what's been the reaction there?
Well, you know, this is really, this has caused serious disquiet because the move to dip into this national trust fund came as a complete surprise, you know, and also I think spotlights the government's pretty, pretty stretched financial predicament. So really a lot of concern how it will impact financial markets is still playing out. But I think what we need to worry about is how rating agencies are going to look at this. You know, this is going to be a problem, you know, and that is where I think the government needs to be very careful in how it pushes ahead to spend this money. If there is any indication that, you know, monies are not being spent properly, particularly because, you know, we don't have a parliament in session and there's really no checks and balances at this point, you know, where these things can be debated. So it is going to be crucial that the government handles this in a very, very transparent manner and not really cause more concern in financial markets that are already now watching Malaysia with a very, very eye.
Leslie, not sure how much you can update us on this one, but this is with regard to the tragedy in Indonesia, the submarine that sank in the north of Bali last week. It's been revealed that a strong underwater wave might have been the cause. 53 crew members on board were killed. What else could you tell us about the incident or perhaps how the tragedy is going to be marked? I mean, with a sub that's over 40 years old, that kind of water pressure, it's going to, you know, the findings, I'm quite worried about the kind of findings that we're going to get out of this.
I know, exactly. You know, the thing is that this is a really sad story. You know, we've seen the Indonesian Navy release kind of a video of the crew singing a farewell song, and that must be heart-wrenching for the families, you know. And I think it's just sad. And, you know, it goes to, you know, these are issues that, you know, when you have vessels that are that old being subjected to, you know, kind of conditions that we don't know, you know. And so this really goes down to management of the military's resources, the Navy's resources. And so I think surely a lot of questions are going to be asked about these issues coming next. And, you know, while the while efforts continue to, you know, recover parts of the sub, which we understand, you know, broke into three pieces, you know, you know, three parts. So, I mean, pretty sad news here, and really nothing more that, you know, I can add to this.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Leslie, let's turn to some developments in the Philippines, because the UN's cultural agency, in fact, awarded the annual Press Freedom Prize to Filipino journalist Maria Ressa. She is well known in circles here, used to be a CNN terrorism investigative reporter, in fact, founded a website called Rappler, and at one point the head of news network ABS-CBN News as well. Good to know for our listeners that Rappler was branded a fake news outlet by President Duterte's administration. And she has her own, being subject to investigations and troubles in the Philippines. Media intimidation, some would say, others, Duterte supporters would say she's just creating a lot of noise and criticism for the administration to continue working and doing whatever it has to do. So what do you think this recognition by the UN means for press freedom in the Philippines?
Well, I think, you know, it's certainly a good sign. I mean, you know, she's certainly been at the really, you know, wrong end of the stick here, you know, receiving a whole lot of brickbats and, you know, coming under criticisms from Duterte, who's pretty powerful, and, you know, and also the other levers of power. And I think, you know, what this shows is that, you know, this recognition will help. You know, Philippines has a very robust, you know, media sector, and
robust.
This is not going to change. Yeah, robust. Yeah, you know, it is very robust. You know, and it's not going to change. So I think, you know, this is good. It is good that, you know, I think it will probably, you know, send a message to the government that, you know, clear, you know, victimizing someone, you know, in a very harsh way just doesn't pay, actually.
However, don't you think, though, that because, as you said, the Philippine media landscape is so robust that every media agency or person or blogger or whatever will have their own agendas as well?
Well, that's true. And, you know, this is how, and ultimately, you know, it's a public that's going to determine whether they receive the kind of, you know, positive public response or not, you know. And so, which is why, you know, it's like Philippines, it is a very, very competitive sector. And, you know, like you pointed out, some do serious work to get recognized, others, you know, kind of skate on thin ice to kind of win that kind of recognition. So that's why I say it's robust.
Very politically correct there. Leslie Lopez, Straits Times regional correspondent on the line with us. Leslie, as always, we appreciate your time. Take care and stay safe.
Thank you. Thanks for it.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.